This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This hour, we'll be talking about our planetary neighbor, that rusty red planet the Romans named after their god of war, Mars. And we are in a unique place to talk about Mars. We're the Science Operations Center of the Lunar and Planetary Lab at the University of Arizona in Tucson. And just a few yards from me sits a mock-up of the Phoenix lander, which is sitting on Mars. The Phoenix lander is still filling its ovens with soil on the northern plains, but its days are getting shorter as winter rolls in with mysterious clouds and icy diamond dust. And at more southern latitudes, the rover Opportunity just keeps going. It just rolled out of a crater, peeking over the top of Sandy Victoria Crater. So what's next? Could it be time for another Martian road trip, perhaps a really long one? Today we're going to take a look at the big picture of Mars, what we've learned so far, what scientists still want to learn, and how they're going to do that. And it is the 50th anniversary of NASA this year, after all. Happy birthday, NASA. Joining me here in Tucson to talk about that, the red planet, are my guests, Peter Smith, principal investigator of NASA's Phoenix Mars mission and senior research scientist right here at the Lunar and Planetary Lab at University of Arizona. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira.
Good to see you in person for a change.
And to see you.
Thank you. Alfred McEwen is the principal investigator of the High-Resolution Imaging Science Experiment, the HiRISE, for the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, and a professor of planetary sciences at the Lunar and Planetary Laboratory at UC, University of Arizona. Welcome back to the show, Dr. McEwen. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
William Hartman is the senior scientist at the Planetary Science Institute, and he's also a space artist and author of the book A Traveler's Guide to Mars. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Dr. Hartman. On the phone is Steve Squires, is principal investigator for NASA's Mars Exploration Rover Mission and professor of astronomy at Cornell University in Ithaca. He's joining us from a studio there. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Squires.
Hey, Ira.
Hey, good to talk to you. Well, let me begin here with you, Dr. Smith. Where do we stand? What's new with the lander? I hear the talk about these dust devils. Are they going to blow the lander around, or what's the story?
Well, the nice thing about dust devils is they actually can clean the dust off your solar panels, so these could be friendly dust devils.
Yeah, because dust has been blown off a lot of the Mars rovers and things, luckily.
Well,
yeah.
Solar power is on our mind these days because we're getting towards fall in the northern plains of Mars, and our solar power center, the sun, is dropping lower and lower day by day, and mm-hmm. our days are getting very precious. And mm-hmm. what we want to do in the remaining days is get a sample of that ice that we've been staring at for the last 3 months into our Tiga oven. We want a really rich, icy sample.
How do you do that?
We have a power tool on the end of our arm called a rasp. It's like a circular file. Instead of a drill, it sends little chips right into the back of our scoop, and then we can deliver to the entry port of our Tiga instrument.
Mm-hmm. And what's the schedule for getting that out? Is there tomorrow, today, or?
The schedule is do it as soon as you possibly can while the sun is shining. Uh-huh. So we've pushed everything else aside to make this a high priority, and we're working on it as we speak.
Uh-huh. Steve, let's talk about the Opportunity rover out there in Victoria Crater. Any trouble getting out of that hole?
No, we got out pleasingly well, Ira. We had surveyed the route on our way in. We were pretty confident we would get out fine, and we cruised right out. There were no problems.
Went back in your own footprint, so to speak.
Exactly.
And so where to now? I mean, you've been going so long. Have you exhausted all the usual places?
Well, we've exhausted the easy places, so it's time to do something hard. What we have chosen for Opportunity is something that's bold and difficult and maybe impossible, but we're convinced it's the right thing to try anyway. Victoria Crater, which we've been exploring, is a great big thing. It's half a mile in diameter. It's the largest feature we've ever explored. But to the southeast of this crater, at a distance of 12 kilometers, more than 7 miles, lies a much, much larger crater. If Victoria were the size of a bottle cap, this thing would be larger than a big dinner plate. It's 20 kilometers in diameter, and it's very, very distant, very difficult to get to. We're going to head off towards it.
And how?
And we're going to do our best to reach there.
How long would that journey take?
You know, I don't know, Ira. I think it could take a couple of years. This thing is very, very far away. We've put a total of 12 kilometers on our vehicle since we landed 4.5 years ago, and this is another 12 kilometers away. We think we can drive a lot faster in the future than we have in the past, and so we're going to try it. And the good news is that even if we don't get there for a variety of other reasons, this is kind of the right direction to go anyway. But we're going to try.
A couple of years. Wow. That's a long time. So,
yeah.
So you're just rolling the dice on this one.
We're rolling the dice in a sense. We don't know if we're going to make it to this crater or not.
Mm-hmm.
But we think it's the right direction to go anyway.
Yeah.
As we head towards the south, we're going to be moving into different kinds of rocks than we've seen previously. And then the other thing is one of the things we're looking for these days is rocks that have been thrown out of really large craters. Because what those do is they sample great depths below the planet's surface.
Mm-hmm.
And these loose rocks that have been thrown out of large craters, you're going to expect to see more of them as you move towards large craters. And there are a number of great big craters to the south of us. So south is the right direction to go anyway. So even if we don't make it, we're convinced this is the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a huge feature. It's like I said, it's 20 kilometers in diameter. It's hundreds of meters deep. It's going to be far and away the most spectacular thing we've ever seen, if we can get there. So we're gonna give it a shot.
All right, we'll keep up with you. Alfred McEwen, is HiRISE involved in finding the way for the rovers?
Yes, we have a new image targeted for October 10th, and it'll be a second image for STEREO that's in between Victoria Crater and this new crater that they're headed for, and we'll probably take several others to map that whole crater out in advance, and that will help Steve and his team plan how to drive and what to do when they get there, hopefully.
How big an object can you see from up there?
Can you
see a little rock on the road for him?
The pixel scale is about 25 centimeters to 30 centimeters, about a foot. And so you need several pixels to really see an object. So it's a little better than meter scale. Maybe half a meter you can detect it. There's something there. So we can do a good job of detecting things that are hazardous. As far as detecting the kinds of rocks that they want to examine in detail, probably not.
Mm-hmm. Why were you looking at Iceland?
Iceland, okay. A few years back, I spent some time in Iceland, but that's a...
You didn't expect me to ask you that
question. No, I
didn't. we're pretty sneaky about this.
Iceland's a wonderful analog for processes on Mars, and they're all currently active in Iceland. It has active volcanism, active flooding, active glaciers, active wind erosion and dunes. So all the processes that we think have acted mostly in the past on Mars are right there, happening right now in Iceland. That's a great way to learn about these things.
1-800-989-989-8255 is a number. We're talking about Mars this hour. Let me go to William Hartman. Could magma under the surface of Mars be creating underground aquifers?
Which is one of the really interesting possible goals of exploration. What I think we have thought we've known for some years is that, of course, at the polar caps, there's ice, there's frozen water sitting up on the surface. Peter's group is scratching the surface near the polar cap. There's the ice just centimeters below the surface. But there's a long history of work even before that, that when you look at craters of different sizes on different parts of Mars, the deep ones, if you have a deep enough crater, it's throwing out a muddy slurry instead of just dry dust. So the argument has been since the 80s that you're tapping into ice with those deeper craters. And the interesting thing, this was Steve Squires did some work on this, and a Russian named Ruslan Kuzmin, that as you go toward the equator, it has to be deeper and deeper craters to hit the ice. So it looks like even at the low latitudes, maybe 400 yards down, something like that, you've got an ice layer. The interesting thing then is to think about that's the top of the ice layer, 400 yards down, and maybe 100 yards down at higher latitudes. Where's the bottom of that layer? And on Mars, just as on the Earth, if you go down, 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 it gets warmer. So someplace down there at the bottom, it could be warm enough to melt ice.
So you're talking like it was sort of like sitting on a glacier. That's covered with soil.
It's ice mixed with soil. It's icy. So it's like northern Canada, and it's these permafrost layers. So it means that if there's magma moving around on Mars today, which is a good possibility, we see young volcanic features, there's a possibility of that there are places on Mars where that bottom of that ice layer is melted, and then you have, as you say, possibly an aquifer of liquid water circulating around. Now, all of this is unknown, but you know it's an interesting idea that could be there.
Would it extend around the whole planet, or in
probably
the
not? No. Probably in isolated areas, particularly if there are certain areas with hot magma moving around. Magma could even move into an area and start melting the ice locally in that region.
Mm-hmm. Are there any tectonics on Mars that move this stuff around?
Not to the extent on Earth. We are all familiar with continental drift and big plates moving around on the Earth. It looks like there's been very little of that on Mars. There's a couple of mountain areas that some people think are squeezed up by tectonic movements. There's certainly a lot of fracturing, and there's certainly giant volcanoes, as most everybody's heard.
Mm-hmm. How could you find the magma? How would you know if it were there?
Possibly thermal, infrared thermal sensing from orbit. You could be looking for hotspots. I mean, you could imagine detecting something like Yellowstone Park if there were active, you know, little hotspots.
Nice glacier, you know, nice little spritz of hot water coming out would be nice.
haven't seen it yet, but, you know, as Alfred said, Iceland has a lot of similar analogs, and many people have heard about these narrow gullies that are a few yards wide, maybe 100 yards long, going straight down hillsides where it looks like water might have flowed down those hillsides. We see things just like that in Iceland. And so there's a lot of efforts to go to places like Iceland and try to understand what's happening there. And usually those places are dry volcanic areas in high northern and southern latitudes on Earth. Yeah.
We're going to take a break and come back and talk lots more about Mars with Peter Smith, Alfred McEwen, William Hartman, and Steve Squires. And take your calls here in the audience. Please step up to the mic here in Tucson and ask a question. And you at home, 1-800-989-8255. We'll be right back after this break. Stay with us. I'm Ira Flato. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're broadcasting from Tucson at the Science Operations Center of the Lunar and Planetary Lab at the University of Arizona here. Our number 1-800-989-8255. My guests are Peter Smith, Alfred McEwen, William Hartman, and Stephen Squires. Before we go to the audience for questions, Peter, I want you to explain a little mystery that I was reading about. Maybe it's been cleared up. And that was the idea or the problem that there was not condensation on the soil that was expected to be seen, right? There were, usually when it gets colder and on Earth, little water condenses on the soil, you did not see that.
Well, that's correct, although we have seen frost on the soil. So on the very top layer, you can actually freeze the water out of the atmosphere late at night at the coldest portion of the day. And we do see that the air is very dry, because the air is thin on Mars. It's 1/100th the surface pressure as the Earth, and it's cold, so it doesn't hold much water, perhaps 1/10,000th of what we have even in Tucson. So it's very dry to begin with. So the soils seem to be even drier than you might expect, and we have a very sensitive instrument that looks at conductivity in the soil. And, of course, water is conductive, and we should see some electrical conductivity, even slight amounts of water. So it's a bit of a surprise to find the soil so dry right above an ice layer and on top an atmosphere with water vapor in it.
So can you go down a little deeper and see if it's down further, or is there plans to do that? Or?
That's exactly what we're going to do. Thank
Gee
you.
Gee whiz. I thought you'd volunteer that information. And so you just stick the probe a little deeper in the soil.
We just clear off a few centimeters and stick it in again and try and see if it gets wetter.
Okay. Let's go to the audience. Question here. Yes, sir.
Yep. Terrestrial volcanoes create some rather unique landforms when magma interacts with groundwater. Have you found anything like that in your imagery from Mars?
Alfred?
Yeah. Okay. yes, but we're still waiting to find something that's most definitive. of the types of things we see in Iceland. My brain is on Iceland here, but we do see other things that are indicative of volcano-water interaction, including these cones, the little phreatic cones that form when they're not from a deep volcanic vent, but the lava flow itself has enough heat that it interacts with groundwater or ice that it melts. It makes these little cones called rootless cones. We do see those in Iceland. We do see those very clearly in places. So there's been, and something else that we see that's very interesting. Well, I'm not going to talk about it because we don't understand it yet. But
well, come on, you can't. You just heard 3 million people just heard that. You can't say that.
Okay, we found columnar jointing, which
there
is
you go.
Lava like devil's postpile, and one theory is that you really need lots of water dumped on cooling lava to make that. But what we're realizing is that we really don't understand columnar jointing on Earth yet.
So. We don't know what you're talking about here on Earth. What is columnar jointing? What is that?
Okay, that's where, you know, like Devil's Postpile, where you have these column, hexagonal columns. They're very scenic.
Right.
All the tourist stops go to those. We actually see that on Mars in a crater. It's vertical jointing, and we're looking straight down from above, but it's a crater rim, and the rim bends up the rock, so we can see it. Very, very nice of the crater to do that.
Is this like that monolith in 2001, Space Odyssey?
Yeah, maybe a whole bunch of them right next to each other, yeah.
It's getting more interesting, isn't it? Did you want to say something, William?
Yeah, well, a thing that should be out on the table, too, is that we actually have rocks from Mars from about 5 to 9 different places on Mars, the total number of rocks, something like 30 rocks. Some of the youngest of those are, well, there's one group that's 170 million years old. That's young to a geologist. And a lot of those rocks show evidence of moisture coming into the cracks and leaving the calcium carbonate. That's the bathtub ring kinds of deposits. So it looks like there has been moisture interacting with rocks down through the history of Mars. So that's another clue that maybe water moving around.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones, 1-800-989-8255. Greg in Fort Lauderdale. Hi, Greg.
Ira, how are you doing?
Hi, how are you? Go ahead.
Good. I'd like to ask your panel a question that's kind of bugged me for a long time. Other than trying to see how far down the ice goes, why would you go in and around craters, since craters come from outside of the planet, and you would assume that there would be all of the rocks that the small instrument could gather would be in and around the crater. It wouldn't be native rock.
Steve Squires, can you take a shot at that?
Yeah, actually, craters are just about the best place for us to go. It's very rare when you're near a crater to actually find traces of the object that struck Mars and made the hole in the first place. The hole is much, much bigger than the object itself. What you're seeing is primarily Martian rock.
Oh, I think we lost. Steve, are you there? Oh, we lost.
Martian rock, and it makes a cross-section, picking up the rest of the sentence, a cross-section right through the layered rock. So if you get down into the crater and look at the wall of the crater, it's wonderful. It's kind of like on the Earth, you'd go to the Grand Canyon, go down, look at all those different layers. Well, you can do that in each crater. So each crater becomes a nice little cookie-cutter hole that gives a sample of the upper few hundred yards depth.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to a question here in the audience. Yes.
I have a two-part question. The first part is for Dr. Smith. Is there any possibility of resurrecting the Phoenix mission come next summer when the Arctic thaws out? And secondly, what science can be done on inactive landers or landing sites after the primary missions are finished?
Well, the resurrection question is an interesting one. Remember, as the winter approaches the Phoenix landing site, we actually get so cold that we freeze the carbon dioxide out of the air down to a layer maybe a couple of feet thick. And our solar panels are going to be really stressed trying to hold up that carbon dioxide ice.
Wait. There's going to be a layer on the panels a couple of feet thick?
On the ground and perhaps on the panels.
It's the snow on your car or something.
Exactly. We did not design the solar panel to withstand that sort of abuse. So we do not expect at the freezing cold temperatures and the amount of CO2 ice that will be deposited, that we can survive that sort of treatment. And so it would be it'd be a miracle if we survive through the winter. Let's put it that way.
Steve Squires, are you there? Are you back?
I think I am.
Well, tell us about that. That's interesting because you never expected your rovers to last that long as they have, and they have.
No, we didn't. We designed them to last at least 90 days. I thought maybe we'd get twice that. In fact, we've been going for more than 4.5 years now. The nice thing about having a rover is that you can keep moving to new places. What we have found is that our landing sites are incredibly diverse, incredibly complicated places, and as long as each time we do a long drive, it's almost like going to a new landing site sometimes. So we feel that as long as we've got our wheels turning and the rover's moving and the scenery's changing, we're going to be able to keep doing very, very good science as we move along over the Martian surface.
So you never had to have to worry about that frozen CO2 on your...
No, we don't have that problem because we're close to the equator. We have, in fact, just survived our third winter on the surface of Mars with these vehicles.
Mm-hmm. And
I could address second part of this question. We can keep observing the Phoenix landing site after the end of the mission to observe frost coming and going. It's one of the best observed sites for understanding seasonal processes. It's like a calibration area at this point. We have the in-situ information. So in future years, we'll keep observing that site to see how the seasonal processes occur.
Mm-hmm. But so the critical point is the functioning of the solar panels. Then will they survive the winter?
No,
they won't.
They will not.
No one's taking odds here. No. Little side bets going on. Yes, let's go to the audience here.
Hi. With all the research that have come out of Spirit and Opportunity, and now everything coming from the Phoenix lander, are there any pet projects someone would like to coordinate that research and put it all together for some good stuff?
Well, that's a great idea. I think we need a Martian Institute to take the data from the rovers, from the landers, from the orbiters. There's so much data coming down now. Alfred can speak to how much, but it's a tremendous amount more than has ever been gathered in probably the history of solar system exploration. Mm-hmm. We need people to analyze this data, so I think you're absolutely right. Finding a way to coordinate analysis of these huge data sets is very important.
Mm-hmm. And because the days are growing short, you mentioned before, I want to get into that a little bit, that you want to start shaving the ice, would that be the right way to say it, right below you there and getting pieces off? And how soon can we see that happening?
Well, we attempted it yesterday, and unfortunately it wasn't successful. So we'll be trying again probably early next week.
And what are the obstacles to get making it successful?
Well, we picked the sample up off the ground. We got the chips up into the scoop, put the scoop over the entry port to the TIGA instrument.
The oven.
Dumped the scoop. It hit the screen, and then it stayed on the screen and didn't go through. Even though the screen is much larger than the size of the individual particles, apparently it's gotten sticky at that point and tend to frost up and stick together.
Is it sort of refreezing when you put it back on there? Like, you know, putting your tongue on the pole outside? Or is that part of the problem?
Well, I hadn't thought of it that way.
You know, I mean, I'm serious. You say the holes are big enough for it to fall through.
Yes.
But it's not going through. It's sort of sticking to the screen instead.
This is a devilish material that we're dealing with. It doesn't have the properties of any of the simulants that we were told might be expected in this portion of Mars. And we've tried all kinds of materials in our laboratory. They never did what Mars soil does. Hmm. So we're a bit mystified with how to work with this soil and get it into our instrument ports.
Does that mean you've used up an oven that's clogged with this now and you can't use it again?
Well, the problem is, in order to deliver an icy soil sample to it again, we've still got this material there, and now it's dried out. So we are likely not to get the ice in this oven.
And so there's no way to sort of shake it off?
No.
No. Now, you wish you had done that, built that little vibrating thing you could... Shaking it off.
There's a lot of things we wish, but...
you'll try it again. You'll try it again.
Absolutely.
With another oven? And.
Well, we're still trying to learn a better way to do this. And
I have a few snow cone people who might be able to help you shave it. Teach you how to shave that off a little better. But so that is a real problem, trying to figure out the best way to get the ice. It's an interesting problem.
Martian materials have been a very difficult... set of challenges for us, let's say.
Because you didn't know what to expect. You thought you knew, but this is what the whole frontier is about.
No, we read the travel brochure, but it didn't say anything about this. It didn't get down in the details, you know, that help us design our instruments properly.
Very interesting. All right, a question here, sir.
Well, given the problems that you're having with the lander, If you had the possibility of sending a human there who could, you know, easily interact and solve these problems in real time, if you had a choice, would you send 50 other landers, or would you actually rather send a human to Mars?
Well, my entire career has been sending robotic missions, so I would prefer 50 robotic missions, because the human's going to have his own problems and may not be in a good state to actually help us with our instrument problems.
Mm-hmm. How much have we learned about Mars's polar climate from Phoenix?
Oh, we've been studying the weather day by day. We have a 24-hour weather report for each 24-hour and 40 minutes, I should say, for each sol of the mission. And I think we've collected one of the really fabulous weather data sets about the onset of winter in the polar plains, mm-hmm. including what we see in Tucson often is what we call virga, where ice comes down below the clouds but evaporates before it hits the surface. And a lot of new interesting weather patterns are starting to happen as we move towards winter.
Wow. Talking about Mars this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow in Tucson with Peter Smith of the Phoenix Mars Mission, Alfred McEwen, who's also of the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, William Hartman of the Planetary Institute, and Steve Squires of the Mars Exploration Rover Mission. Steve, when is the rover going to decide to go on that journey? When will you kick the tires and get it going?
I think it's probably going to be within the next week, Ira. We've pretty much finished up our work at Victoria Crater, and we're going to hit the gas probably middle of next week.
Wow. And how far per day can it make its way?
We think that we can average 100 meters each day that we drive. And I should point out what you asked Alfred earlier: was high rise involved in planning this drive? And his response was actually way too modest. The reality is that high rise is what's enabling this drive. We wouldn't dare try this if we didn't have the high-rise data. But what high-rise does is it provides us with a spectacular roadmap that tells us how to get from here to where we're going. So we think that with the high-rise data as a guide, we can probably do better than 100 meters, 100 yards in a day.
Wow. Have you found a different way to steer it or automate
well,
it?
Well, there are a couple things. The rover has gotten smarter. What we've done, even as the vehicle has aged mechanically, it's gotten smarter in its software. We've uploaded new software to it that enables it to better find its way through obstacles and around obstacles. We're smarter ourselves. We've got years of driving experience under our belts now. We know how to deal with all sorts of difficult circumstances. And we think the combination of us being smarter, the rover being smarter, and especially having those high-rise images, we think we can do 100 meters a day.
Wow. Jennifer in Hawking Hills, Ohio. Hi, Jennifer.
Hello. I love this program. I look forward to it every month or every week. But you have an excellent panel. I love looking at Mars, but I also love looking at the moon. And I wonder if your excellent panel knew about a lunar crash which was sample debris of present-day water in the South Pole. It was in the Columbus Dispatch, Columbus, Ohio, in 2006, and supposedly they're still planning on NASA to shoot two missiles into the South Pole of the Moon in October, which is next month, mm-hmm. To see if there's water there, just like you guys are looking for water on Mars.
Let me ask Alfred McEwen. He's raised his hand on it.
Okay. Yeah, the European European Science Agency had a Mars mission, SMART 1, which they attempted to crash into the South Polar ice to look for ice. They actually missed. They actually crashed in a place away from the ice. But then with the launch, it was to be October. It's now delayed till April of the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. It also has another the booster for LRO is a separate space probe called L-Cross, which will be directed into a polar shadow.
Yeah, the South Pole.
It's actually going to be the North Pole because the launch was delayed, and to view it from Earth, they had to switch to the North Pole. But the idea is that
will it be two missiles?
What happens is the cruise stage goes in first with a separate spacecraft that observes it, and then that separate spacecraft, which is much smaller, goes in, which won't create as much of a bang or plume. So it is two two objects that go in, yes.
All right, thanks for calling. You're a great Mars observer and moon specialist. Thanks for calling. 1-800-989-8255. We're going to have to take a break and come back and talk lots more about Mars. We'll talk about future Mars missions. What's in the future for maybe 5, 10 years from now? What other kinds of probes might we send? What's on the drawing boards? Your questions? So stay with us. We'll be right back after the short break. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about Mars, from the latest news streaming back from landers and rovers and satellites to the puzzle scientists are still trying to solve. My guests are Peter Smith, principal investigator on the Phoenix Mars mission, Alfred McEwen, principal investigator of the high-resolution imaging science experiment, the high-rise for the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, William Hartman, senior scientist at the Planetary Science Institute in Tucson, and Steve Squires, principal investigator for the Mars Exploration Rover mission. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. I want to talk about the future now, the future of exploration, but let's get some perspective. I'd like to ask you, William Hartman, you go way back in this program. You were working with Carl Sagan way back during the Mariner mission, were you not?
Yeah, the first Mariners were flybys in the 60s, and then Mariner 9 went into orbit in 71, and I was this very lucky generation of the first handful of scientists interested in planets coming out from the two or three professors of that era, Gerard Kuiper being my professor. And so my lucky story was I'm sitting in my office at the University of Arizona and the fledgling assistant professor, and my phone rings, and it's Bruce Murray, who was the head of Jet Propulsion Lab. We've got this Mariner 9 flying to Mars. Do you want to be on our imaging team? And, you know, today you announce a mission from NASA to Mars, and there's 200 fledgling young PhDs all competing to try to get on that, and there's never quite enough slots for all the people who would like to be doing this kind of research.
Mm-hmm. And were you looking for water in those days, too?
Well, nobody knew what we were going to see. The two Mariners that went by in the 60s happened to photograph the side of Mars that had craters on it. So the paradigm at the end of the 60s was Mars is like the moon with a little bit of air to blow the dust around, and that's the end of the story. We get Mariner 9 there. It goes into orbit. It's the first mapping of the entire planet from orbit. And it happened to arrive during a dust storm, so we have to wait for the dust to clear. The dust is settling. And finally, one day, Carl Sagan comes running downstairs from up in the computer room where the computer he could photograph with a Polaroid camera, you know, and bring it downstairs to the team room to show us what the picture was. And here was the top of this giant volcano sticking through the dust haze layer. So First big discovery, 75,000-foot-high volcano on Mars. But as the dust settled, what did you see on this frozen, dusty, dry planet, but dry riverbeds all over the place? And so that was the big shock, that it, you know, there just doesn't seem to be any way around that there was water, perhaps small amounts, a little bit at a time. I mean, maybe these were one-month floods. We don't know. But there was water running around carving rivers on Mars. They look just like our grand river out here in Tucson, the San Pedro, which is a dusty, dry riverbed.
Were these the canals that they were drawing years ago?
No. The canals are the story that go back to the 1890s, right. Percival Lowell, H.G. Right. Wells. They thought they saw straight lines. What they were really seeing, a lot of that came from the streaks, dusty, straight wind streaks, where the wind blows and circulates behind a mountain or a crater as it goes by, and on the leeward side you get a streak. And those change a little bit from year to year, and that's what apparently they were seeing. But there's a little bit of confusion about that, because the name they picked for these dry riverbeds was channels, and then we had to always explain, well, channels aren't the same thing as these old canals that don't really exist the way Percival Lowell thought they did.
Oh, very interesting. Let's look to the future. Steve Squires, looking ahead 10, 15 years, what would you like to see the big science goals for Mars? Bring something back?
Well, eventually, yes. I mean, the first thing that we're going to do is there's a mission called the Mars Science Laboratory that is going to launch in 2009, and that's another rover. And this rover is bigger and more capable. It's got a very powerful scientific payload that can detect trace abundances of organic molecules if they're there. And that mission is going to launch soon and is going to go to Mars and pick up where we left off. And whereas our rovers were designed to last only 90 days and have lasted 4.5 years, this thing is designed to last for 2 Earth years. And so goodness knows how long this thing could go on. So that's going to be a very capable mission.
And it can...
Then after that, as you say, the next big thing, what I think many of us have hoped for many years, is to actually bring carefully selected rocks back from Mars, bring them into laboratories on Earth and take them apart.
Mm-hmm. Peter Smith, what's next for you? What would you like to do besides get that ice back in those hoppers? What would you do on the next mission?
Well, if someone were to fund a mission...
Let me give you the blank check question I give
The blank check, guests. Yes. That would help.
You have the blank check.
You know, we've scraped the top of this ice layer, but I'd love to know how deep it goes. Where's the bottom? And as Bill was pointing out, maybe there's even a liquid layer underneath the ice as the planet starts to warm towards its interior. And I think analyzing layer by layer through this ice is going to tell us a lot about the history of Mars. So I'd love to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. And so you need a drill, I guess.
Drill, exactly.
Send a drill and drill rig. We drill
exactly.
Here. Let's drill here. Sort of thing like that. Okay.
Drill baby drill.
Drill baby drill,
drill
right
baby
here.
Drill.
Drill baby drill on Mars.
You have a place where they can do that.
And you have a spot right for them.
It's on the
it won't hurt
North
anybody.
Shore. That's where it is.
That's way offshore. It's on a different planet.
Gotcha, Ira.
That was good. I'm glad you said it, not me, on that one. Let's talk, William Hartman. So, what you write about a traveler's guide to Mars? There aren't any hotels up there yet, but maybe if we drill and find some energy in there.
Yeah, it was a title thought up by the publisher, but the idea was to talk about individual places on Mars that we could go, and tell the story of Mars that way. I think a direction toward the future is indicated by a mission that I'm currently involved with, which is the European Mars Express mission, which incidentally gives a chance to say, I think one of the great things about planetary exploration is that it's so international, because goodness knows we need to understand socio-political ways that our mm-hmm. different countries can work together, and I think planetary science is an example of that. So anyway, what the Mars Express mission is sending back, from what I'm hearing in those meetings, is that imagine going back to the 70s, the United States Geological Survey is getting these pictures and they're mapping Mars, and they detected sort of 3 geological units that they thought were different, the oldest one, the middle one, and the youngest one. And we didn't really have any way of confirming that there was something unique about each period, but they thought they could see some differences in the rock style and so forth. Here comes Mars Express with a super-duper spectrometer looking down from orbit. And what they're reporting is that the oldest unit, the rock types that they see are dominated by clays. And the middle unit, the rock types that they're seeing, are dominated by sedimentary rocks. Big excitement, you know, not just all volcanism. Sulfate sedimentary rocks, which ties in with Steve Squires, because that's what they're seeing on the ground when the mm-hmm. rover is driving around. And then the latest period is dominated by these rusty red minerals that make the red color. So what seems very exciting to me about that is here's a planet where there really seem to be 3 different rock types that are kind of dominating different periods, rather than it being the same the whole history mm-hmm. of the planet, mm-hmm. which gets at the whole question of, has the climate really radically changed? Has the environment changed on Mars? And I think those are the kinds of things we're going to be trying to look for. If we can drive rovers around, can we find these different rock types and really understand them mm-hmm. on the ground? What's causing those differences?
Well, let me ask all 3. Will understanding Mars tell us anything about the evolution on Earth of our planet?
Yeah. Alfred? Absolutely. And one of the most important time periods for understanding the origin of life, and the reason we have a Mars exploration program, is to understand the origins of life or whether there's life elsewhere. But on Earth, life probably originated during a period of heavy bombardment. That was like 3.9 billion years ago and earlier. But we have no rock record. No rocks have survived from that period. They've all been metamorphosed and recrystallized. A few zircons have survived. We know almost nothing about that time period on Earth. On Mars, rocks in that time period are preserved. And Mars may have been very Earth-like in that time period. It's a planet that was rich in ice. Many impacts to melt the ice, create hydrothermal systems, and so forth. So we have a chance on Mars to really understand this crucial time period when life originated on Earth and what those environments were like.
Mm. So a geological preserve there of ancient Earth.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
That's the ultimate driving question, too, because, I mean, that question of did life form on Mars, such a perfect science question, because either answer is so profound. You know, if it did, that's the first time that we know in all of human history that we know we're not alone in the universe, that there was actually life someplace else. And you know, everybody's used to Sigourney Weaver chasing aliens around and so forth, but the fact is we don't actually know whether there have ever been any aliens. On the other hand, if you really poked around Mars long enough and you conclude that life just really never formed there, in spite of this planet with water at the beginning and all that, rather Earth-like conditions at the beginning, we think, and if life never formed, that's profound also, you know, because maybe we're really more alone in the universe than we think. So I think that's the big philosophic underlying question of all this Mars exploration, and we have a chance to do that as these rovers get more sophisticated and we learn more about the history, the chronology of Mars.
We always like to leave people something for Friday night to ponder over of
that's,
the Earth.
That's
a great little question. Let me go to the audience here. Yes.
First of all, thank you so much for all that you've done, not just the panelists, of course, but everyone involved in this mission. At a time when we need imagination so badly and new ideas, you have given us so much to think about. Congratulations and thank you from all of us everywhere, listening audience and here. Two questions. One, how do you keep a fresh perspective? You're just talking about, you know, we're looking at did life start there, and then how does that apply to us? How do you keep out of being so ethnocentric that you might miss something standing over here that's saying, hi, look at over here. This is really different. How do you keep that fresh perspective? And secondly, in a time of economic upheaval, to say the least, how do we keep people focused on funding the things that we need to fund? Because our future is certainly not just on this planet. Our future is in space. How do we keep people focused on funding what we need to do for exploration? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, the data always...
Go ahead.
Keep the fresh perspective, because the data, you know, force you to say, oh, my gosh, what is this? So you don't have too much time just sitting around scratching your head, you know, wondering what's there.
But this comes up a lot in the search for life on Mars, that we're searching for life as we know it, because that's the only thing we know how to search for. But what if there's something totally different?
Or ice, like we can't get through the operas. We don't know how that, what kind of soil that even. I'm not saying this to be funny. It's just very interesting stuff you can't even predict. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. And I think that's the joy of all this stuff, is not knowing. Quick question here, yes.
When we were talking about life on Mars, when you were putting these two missions together, was there a concern that you would inadvertently bring life to Mars? And if so, what was done to prevent it?
Yes, there is a big concern about that. In fact, we have a planetary protection bureaucracy, if you like, in this country and around the world that tries to make sure that we don't contaminate our neighboring planets.
You call them men in black at all?
Not to their faces. she would be quite offended. But we have special rules that we follow to make sure our spacecraft is clean to the standards that have been agreed upon by international committees that worry about this sort of thing. And then, of course, since we're looking for life, we have built an instrument here at the University of Arizona that was done in an extremely clean environment. And it was quite a challenge to put together an instrument under those conditions of cleanliness and still have it function, because you can't put in ordinary greases and things that you would normally use. So we have a very organic-free instrument, and the robotic arm that delivers the samples was preserved inside of a biobarrier after being sterilized, I think it was 50 hours at 125°C, well above boiling, to make sure that it did not have any living microbes on it, because it's going to touch the icy soil. And so we have been going to great lengths, both to make sure we don't contaminate Mars in a place where it might be a habitable environment, and also to make sure we don't make a mistake and think we found life on Mars when we actually brought it with us.
Mm. Last question from the audience.
As a non-science person, this technology is amazing to me, and I'm just wondering, other than a drill, what technology has been developed since Mars, the lander was launched, or what technology was not available to you that you hope you have for the next mission?
Well, one thing we've done with this mission is look for just the basic ingredients of habitability, and when it comes to living structures, microbes or whatever they might be on Mars, we have only the ability to say that these are organic materials, carbon chains of materials. We don't know what carbon chain it is. Is it a protein, a DNA? And instruments exist now, and the field of microbiology is so vibrant these days that you can now build instruments that will actually tell you exactly what these organic materials are, and the instruments are small. And I think if we could find a place on Mars where we knew there was these organic compounds, we would certainly want to send those sorts of instruments to find out if there were DNA structures, proteins, amino acids, all the whole range of things.
Steve Squires, anything you'd like to add to that?
I think the only thing that I would mention about the technology is that you might actually be surprised by how low-tech some of these spacecraft are. I'll give you the example of our rovers. The computer inside our rover was a smoking hot machine in about 1987. Your cell phone is smarter than our rovers are. But what we do is we focus on taking existing proven technologies that we know will work out at the distance of Mars and try to combine them together in new and innovative ways. And that's what we did on the rovers, and that's what Peter and his team did on Phoenix as well. So we will continue to look for new technologies and then apply them in future missions. But the problem is you can't go out there and fix something when it breaks. Right. So you got to go with something that's pretty well tested.
Thanks, Steve. Thank you all. Steve Squires, Principal Investigator for NASA's Mars Exploration Rover Mission and Professor of Astronomy at Cornell. William Hartman, Senior Scientist at the Planetary Science Institute in Tucson. Alfred McEwen, Principal Investigator of the High Resolution Imaging Science Experiment for the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. Also Professor of Planetary Sciences at the Lunar and Planetary Laboratory at University of Arizona in Tucson. Also there, Peter Smith, Principal Investigator of NASA's Phoenix Mars Mission and Senior Research Scientist here. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today. Our program is produced by Christopher Tagliata and Senior Producer Annette Heiss. Charles Berquist is our director. Gwen Uten directed from Washington. Flora Lichtman is our producer for digital media. Our intern is Molly Ashford. Josh Rogerson is our technical director at the controls here and joined by Leo Delaglia. So we'd like to thank them both. Also like to thank Pete Michaels and everyone at KUAZ for making our trip possible, and Sarah Hammond and Gwenny Furr here at the Lunar and Planetary Lab. Enrique Rivera and Ashley Grashaw screened our calls today, and we had help in Second Life from Lynn Collins, Dave Andrews, Jeff Corbin, and University of Denver. If you'd like to write us, please send your letters to Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, room 306, New York, New York, 10036. Also, we're podcasting and blogging, so we'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in Tucson.